All right, so we are in week 6, chapter 5 of Daniel, and if I remember right, we read question 2, but we didn't really fully answer the section 2 question. So I'll start out by reading the chapter, and then we can go straight to the section 2. All right. Chapter 5, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar's father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you, or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a gold chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I'll read the writing of the king to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was fed with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house has been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parsin. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. All right. Okay, so we covered the initial part with their feast, and now we're on to section 2 in page 44 at the bottom, an unreadable message. While Belshazzar sees the fingers of a human hand appearing and writing on the wall, he cannot read the message. Nevertheless, he's overtaken with extreme fear, so much so that his limbs gave way. Why is this immediate reaction one of fear and dread? And why does it get worse so that he's greatly alarmed? Right. Anyone have anything? So the first question is kind of before he calls on the enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers. And then, so in first it says his thoughts alarmed him. And then after his wise men couldn't help him, and it says he was greatly alarmed. So she said that.
Remember everything in the past, what happened back then.
So should it be what she said? She said that he remembered back in history, and he kind of knew that this was God, and he also remembered like everything God has done to his father, Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, so even if he doesn't necessarily remember, you know, everything that happened to Nebuchadnezzar, he definitely can realize that, you know, there's something supernatural going on. And whether, you know, even if he doesn't know the source of it, he you know, just the fact that something supernatural is going on is probably filling him with fear.
I think with the fact that he likely realized that and then the second part of the question, why did he become greatly alarmed? Mm-hmm. His immediate solution was to go to all of his sources of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, he brought in all of his answer men.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were perplexed,
mm-hmm.
then he really knew what he was dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
That's I think, how that progression would roll through there.
Mm-hmm. And that's something we see over and over in Daniel, right? Like Nebuchadnezzar did it back in chapter 2 and in chapter 4. As soon as he kind of gets a crisis, he calls these. It's the same people, the enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, and then they can't help it. And then after that, he remembers like Daniel and his friends. And also, so in here, the question asks, like, his limbs gave way. So I was reading that phrase can also be translated as his loins were loosed, which essentially means that he lost control of his bladder or bowels. So here's the guy, you know, he's partying, and he has all these people, and then, you know, God, like, takes control, and he, like, embarrasses him. So the next section is a forgotten interpreter. The queen mother enters into the chamber to tell Belshazzar of the existence of Daniel, who had become well known as a person of light and understanding and wisdom. She encourages Belshazzar to consult with this Daniel and refers to him by his Babylonian name, Belteshazzar, which probably means, O lady, wife of the Babylonian god Bel, protect the king. Why is the mention of his Babylonian name so ironic in this context? The Carol said the king wasn't going to be protected by the wife of the Babylonian god. Anyone else? So yeah, so Belshazzar also, it's similar to Belteshazzar. So Belteshazzar means basically Bel, you know, the Babylonian god Bel, protect the king. And Belteshazzar means the wife of the Babylonian god, protect the king. And basically the irony here, I guess, is kind of how, you know, both of their names is calling on this god, this Babylonian god, to protect them. But essentially you have Daniel, who doesn't believe in this god, but he's the only one who's really trying to help the situation. He's the only one who can help them in the situation. Right. So moving on, I guess section 4 is a message of judgment. It says here, Daniel alone is able to interpret the writing on the wall. But before he gives Belshazzar the message, he first compares him to King Nebuchadnezzar. What are the points of similarity and the points of difference between Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar? And it might be useful to review Daniel 4. So Daniel 4 is Nebuchadnezzar's second dream, where he was in his house and he gets the dream about his on the tree. And then it's the same story where he tries to get his wise men to interpret it, and they're of no help. And then Daniel tells him about the incoming judgment. And at the end, I guess we can just read the last verse in chapter 4. So this is after Nebuchadnezzar gets the mind of an animal, and then after he's restored, he kind of finishes it by saying, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he's able to humble." So how is that different or similar to what's going on here in chapter 5? Okay. So she said they were both prideful, and both of them got the warning from God, but in Nebuchadnezzar's case, he actually was, He kind of repented and was restored, but not Belshazzar. Anyone else? So yes, similar to what Nirpa said, there's no confession at the end. So far in kind of the first four chapters of Daniel, we see at the end there's some kind of declaration of confession, where Nebuchadnezzar, he acknowledges God, and even though it seems like in the very next chapter he forgets what happened, at least at the end of the chapter he acknowledged God. But we don't see that in chapter 5. There's no Nebuchadnezzar, there's no Belshazzar at the end of the chapter, and there's no more kingdom. And also, so this is not a dream. This is actually something that's actual writing that everyone can see. But so in the others, it was just Nebuchadnezzar's dream, especially in chapter 2, where he doesn't even tell people what his dream was. He's expecting them to figure out the dream and the interpretation. But in this case, it's not, you know, everyone can see the writing. There are like 1,000 lords and you know, all his wives and concubines, and he brings his wise men, but none of them understood what was going on. And kind of the similarities is just like chapter 2 and 4. As soon as they hit the crisis, the kings turned to the right-hand men, the wise men. But it's also interesting that they never turned to Daniel first, even though we see back in chapter 1 that Daniel's essentially like the valedictorian of the Babylonian school. And it's always Daniel and his friends were, they were given these high positions, but they always keep kind of turning to these people who are, I guess they're like more comfortable with them, but the wise men can never do anything to help the situation. And so kind of similar to this, there's also how Daniel, when he walks in, there's difference in just how Daniel approaches the king. So in here, he kind of walks in and he kind of abruptly just says, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards another. And then he kind of says, nevertheless, I'll read the writing, and he goes on. But this is very different from, I guess, even like chapter 4, where when Daniel comes in, he starts out saying like, I guess in 4, verse 19, he says, my Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you, and its interpretation for your enemies. And he, and Daniel just seems much more kind of abrupt and rude, almost, in chapter 5. And not just to what he was in chapter 4, but also even compared to the queen. The queen comes in and she says, like, oh, king, live forever. You know, don't let your thoughts alarm you. And she seems more like formal to kind of how you address a king. And Daniel just keeps kind of, he just comes in. He's kind of abrupt and rude. So do we have any thoughts around kind of why?
With Belshazzar, because Daniel had a particular respect for Nebuchadnezzar in some sense, but he doesn't seem to have it for
Belshazzar.
That seems to be a pretty big difference. Does it have anything to do as well with there's not really any developed history of a relationship? There's no circumstances, if this is the only interaction that you see, and it's one of just blatant, like thumbing your nose at the God of Daniel, and you haven't learned anything. So it's almost like Daniel responds to him the way that he's almost asking to be treated. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a stretch, I suppose, but just hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Is that what the question is? Why do you think?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, it's also interesting when the queen talks about Daniel, she mentions how there's a guy in the kingdom who was the chief of the magicians and how Nebuchadnezzar found him very helpful. But then when Belshazzar addresses Daniel, he actually says, "You are Daniel, one of the exiles from Judah." He's almost like he's putting him in his place, like, this is who you are. Not like, and I mean, later on he does mention how he's supposed to be, he's heard of his excellent wisdom, but he starts out like, putting him in his place almost. And I also thought of how last week we talked about how at this point Daniel's probably in his 80s. So here's kind of this old guy's, probably like his best days are behind him and kind of his greatest works have been forgotten. But he's brought in to the king who has all the power. He probably is like in the prime of his life. But he has no aware of what's going on around him, like, the feast and, he doesn't understand the writing on the wall. He doesn't quite understand the seriousness of the enemy being outside the gates. But Daniel is he's the one who's sober. He's showing self-control. And I probably at this point, he doesn't really, he knows that this, he doesn't really need to address this guy who's drunk, with all the, how he addressed him, Nebuchadnezzar, which, so the next question here is about the writing on the wall. But before we get there, so there's also this interesting thing about how Daniel doesn't just go straight to what those words mean. He actually kind of gives Belshazzar kind of a history of what happened between him and Nebuchadnezzar. And I thought that even though he starts out sounding very abrupt and rude, he actually is showing compassion to this king who really doesn't understand kind of the history of the country. He doesn't understand what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, so he's actually taking the time to kind of help him understand, like, this is Nebuchadnezzar's story, and this is what's going on. Because it would have been, really easy for Daniel to just come in there and say, these are what the words mean, and, you're going to die tonight, and it happens. But he actually takes the time to, help him kind of understand what's going on. But even with that, Belshazzar doesn't seem to really show any remorse or repentance compared to how Nebuchadnezzar reacted. All right. So our last question for this week is the writing on the wall. So we're in page 46 now. The writing on the wall is a collection of Aramaic words, mene, mene, tekel, and parsin, which are measures of weight listed in decreasing order. Presumably the king's wise men could have read these rather basic terms, but they were evidently unable to understand their meaning and implications. If the terms are read as verbs, the meaning becomes numbered, numbered, weighed, and divided, which is the meaning Daniel gives to them. How does Daniel then apply this message to Belshazzar? What does it mean for him and for his kingdom? Anyone have anything on this?
Uh-huh. Weighed and found deficient. Uh-huh. The kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians.
Uh-huh. Anyone else have anything else? All right. So that's essentially kind of what it explains later in the chapter, right? What each of those words mean. And it's interesting how, even though they say that they didn't understand it, they knew what those words meant. They just didn't when it says like those are measures of weight or currency, it probably said something like, you know, like ton, pound, ounce, which doesn't make any sense. But and Lucy actually, you know, like Daniel interprets them as verbs instead of nouns. And even that, when it just says numbered, weighed, and divided, doesn't necessarily make much sense. And so so one of the things about why these measures and weights were used is, I guess since kind of ancient times, multiple civilizations have all used weights and measures as symbols for kind of justice and righteousness. I guess it's true for us today too, like what is our symbol for the law? We have the lady with the scales, right? And I guess that's kind of like if you ask an average man in the street, like, you know, how do you get to heaven? Most people are likely to answer, like, you know, like my good deeds, so you're going to outweigh the bad deeds, and that's how I get to heaven. So that's kind of the common understanding of, you know, using kind of measurements and weights to determine kind of good versus bad. And that essentially gets to the interpretation of how, you know, God is the one who's actually measuring Belshazzar and weighing him. So anyone have anything else from these questions for reflection and discussion before we move on to the gospel glimpses stuff? Okay, so we can go on to gospel glimpses. So first one is the cry from the cross. In this story, the writing on the wall is a declaration of divine condemnation. God has tolerated Belshazzar's pride and rebellion long enough. The time has come for justice to reign. As such, this story reminds our fallen world that we too, like Belshazzar, ought to see the writing on the wall. Indeed, as the Apostle Paul says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Romans 1:18. Are we not all liable to the same fate that met Belshazzar? And yet God, in his grace and mercy, has set forth the Son to be a sin offering for us, so that instead of having to see the writing on the wall, we can hear the cry from the cross. It's finished. John 19:30. For our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. 2 Corinthians 4:5-21. All right, so kind of any other gospel glimpses that anyone saw from this section? I guess one thing I noticed, not necessarily just in chapter 5, but kind of throughout Daniel in general, how Daniel is this, you know, someone who has the wisdom to interpret what is going on in the situation. And I thought it was similar to how you have Jesus who's coming to live, you know, he's coming to live among us. And the Bible talks about how he grew in wisdom and favor. And, you know, like throughout his life, he's kind of interpreting what's actually going on in the world. All right. And next is the whole Bible connections. So here the author talks about the worship of idols. During the revelry and merrymaking of Belshazzar's great feast, things came to a crescendo. And Belshazzar not only defiles the vessels of the temple, but indeed praises the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. This is outright blasphemy and open rebellion against God, the maker of heaven and earth, who alone deserves all glory, honor, and praise. Ironically, as pride exalts a man, he's all the more willing to prostrate himself before idols. We see this pattern again and again in the Bible as the prophets polemicize against the folly of worshiping graven images in whom there's no life. You can see Isaiah 40 to 48. So too the Apostle Paul critiques the idols of Athens, declaring that these images are merely human products formed by the art and imagination of man. And any other kind of whole Bible connections, or does anyone want to talk about kind of what you thought of the worship of idols? And going back to what Seth was talking about, how the first thing they do is they kind of go to the wise men, and then it's almost like, you know, whenever we reach a crisis point, you know, we first kind of turn to kind of our kind of people that we kind of rely on, and then God shows them, like, you know, the people that you turn to first are not necessarily as helpful, and you know, eventually you learn to turn to the right place. Anyone else? Thank you for that. So did everyone kind of get where the lampstand is mentioned in this chapter? So it's like right when we read about the kind of the writing in like verse 5, it says, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And this lampstand possibly is, you know, one of the vessels that they took out from the temple. So not just the vessels that they're using to drink wine and partying, but also this, you know, this lampstand. Another kind of whole Bible connection, I guess, that I noticed was the parable of the, I guess it's called the parable of the rich fool. This is in Luke chapter 12. I'll read from verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbiter over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told him a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully." And he thought to himself, "What shall I do, for I have nowhere to store my crops?" And he said, "I'll do this. I'll tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I'll store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." So I thought, you know, this is kind of essentially kind of a reflection of, you know, what happened in chapter 5, where they know that there's this army outside the gates, but they trusted, you know, whatever it said, like they had 20 years of provision stored up, and they thought that they have these impenetrable walls. And just like what happened to the, you know, the rich fool, you know, what happened to Belshazzar. So one thing, I guess before I kind of forgot that I wanted to mention was, so we see how Daniel says, like, you know, "I don't want your rewards," but then even the Belshazzar doesn't really appreciate his message if you don't see him like repenting or doing anything about it, but he does keep his word. Maybe it's because, you know, he promised it in front of like his thousands of his lords and he can't go back on it, but he does keep his word. He does give Daniel the, you know, the purple cloth, the chain of gold, and he makes a proclamation that he's the third ruler in the kingdom, which kind of seems, you know, it doesn't really matter because that very night the kingdom's gone. But I guess kind of we might see this, talk about this more in chapter 6, but the way the, I guess, the Medes, the Persians, their kind of kingdom ruling philosophy is a lot different from the Babylonians. So you see the Babylonians, they kind of prefer like a centralized power, have the king have all the power. So when they go capture Jerusalem, they bring their best back to Babylon so that, you know, you have the best in Babylon. And but the Persians had a much different philosophy in that they kind of preferred, even though they do kind of go over, take over kingdoms, they kind of let those kingdoms kind of self-rule as long as you're paying tribute to the, you know, the actual king. So they're more into independent rule. So we know that Belshazzar dies, and then who's kind of the second in command, and then we also know that king, Nabonidus, he probably also died. So essentially, when the Persians take over, Daniel's kind of the, you know, he's the highest ranking official still alive, which probably made, you know, when they kind of give them almost like independent rule, he probably had a lot of status when the Persians took over. And also, kind of going off of that, so this is kind of the end of the chapter where, you know, this is the end of the kingdom of Babylon. So what we see in back in kind of Daniel chapter 1, and what we see in the Old Testament, so Babylon's kind of been on the scene for a while. They were first kind of, they started attacking Jerusalem, and we read in like Jeremiah how the king is trying to like make a alliance with the Egyptians to see if they can kind of team up against Babylon, but that eventually doesn't work out. And then, you know, the kingdom of Judah is no more, and they're taken into exile. And this is kind of the end of the whole kind of the story arc. And so what we see here is not just that, you know, God is sovereign. He's kind of, you know, God is not just replacing one kingdom with another kingdom, but we almost see, so this is kind of the beginning of their story taking a different turn. So we first see in the beginning of Daniel how these kind of teenagers are taken in exile, and they're they're basically assaulting their identity, trying to get them to change. So at the end of this chapter says, how Darius indeed received the kingdom. But eventually you'll see that the actual king is King Cyrus. And if we turn to 2 Chronicles, this is really the last. The end of 2 Chronicles. I guess I can read from verse 22. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. So this is like, almost a crazy ending to where we see how Daniel starts, where the king has destroyed the country. He's taking the sacred vessels from the temple, and he's taking these exiles. And then essentially like 5 chapters later, we see this pagan king who's saying, the God of heaven has given me all these kingdoms so that he can rebuild the temple again. So I guess we can go back to our study guide here. So last section's on theological soundings. Willful ignorance. Because of sin, human beings have the ability to induce within themselves a willful ignorance of the truth, so that what should be obvious to them is nevertheless lost upon them. They're ignorant of it, not because they lack exposure to it, but because they choose to deny what is plain to them. We see willful ignorance in Belshazzar, which only multiplies his guilt before the Lord. He no doubt has heard what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, how he was humbled by the God of Israel and once restored gave God praise, Daniel 4. But in his pride and folly, Belshazzar seems blissfully unaware of this, and yet we learn from the Apostle Paul that willful ignorance operates in every fallen heart, as people suppress the knowledge of God to such an extent that they become ignorant of him, even to the point of denying his existence as they worship idols. And I guess I can go ahead and read the next one too. Divine judgment. While God is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, his mercy does have limits. It's indeed possible for someone to become hardened beyond the point of redemption. Hebrews warns of this as a possibility. If you go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume dead adversaries. Belshazzar experienced God's definitive judgment against his sin. But Hebrews warns that those who are privileged to know about the good news of Jesus Christ are liable to an even more severe judgment should they reject this knowledge and profane Jesus' sacrifice. So, any thoughts on willful ignorance or divine judgment? Or if you have any other theological soundings, gospel glimpses, or whole Bible connections?
I don't know if this, which categories fit in, but I do see I first started thinking about when Jesus cleansed the temple. That was his father's house. He responded in righteous anger and just turned the place upside down. But I also was thinking of that in comparison to he went by the angels who visited Sodom and Gomorrah, found something very similar, although that wasn't his house, and he turns the place upside down, fire and brimstone. When he looks down at the humankind in the days of Noah, same thing, and he just wipes the planet of Earth clean with his blood. And then you see that again, coming to, there's righteous fiery indignation coming again, and he's going to recreate. The theology that I saw there was that God is faithful every single time. He's proven what he's going to do, and he's promised to do it again, and we can Mm-hmm. I just, the account of him doing that and just, you know, numbered weight divided, game over.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You know, there's no circumnavigating that. Even the salvation of Christ is right in the middle of it. That's the escape route that's right in the middle of all that working out.
Mm-hmm. So. Thank you. Anyone else have any other gospel glimpses or Bible connections or theological soundings? Or we can even go to the personal implications where you have any other reflections from this chapter. So one thing I noticed is, we kind of talked about how, yeah, Belshazzar's the king who's partying and he thinks he has all this power, but in reality, you know, there's the enemy waiting outside the city gates to, you know, take over that very night. And we actually, there's some historical evidence that the Persians actually, they knew that this was an annual feast and they've kind of planned that. You know, they knew that the king would be distracted, so this very night we're going to, you know, this is our night for attack. And so they say that what they did was Babylonian did have these like impenetrable walls, but they have the big river, I guess it's Euphrates, which is running through it, and they figured out a way to dam the river kind of up front and kind of divert it. And it's also said that they probably had some deserters from Babylon who were helping them figure it out, but they basically diverted the river and found a way to go under the walls and get into the city. And while the king has all his best nobles there, you know, they're partying, there was really no one there who could kind of figure out what was going on, and they took him by surprise that night. And so we see how Belshazzar, he thinks he has all this power, but he's kind of unaware of what's going on, versus Daniel, who's, you know, he's old and his greatest deeds are kind of forgotten by the kingdom except the queen mother. But he's the one who's really, you know, he's the one who's actually useful to God. And I thought it was kind of similar, kind of, you have this actual human status versus character. And I thought it was similar to how when God picked David for king over all his brothers, Samuel's looking at the brothers and how they're, you know, they're big and tall and they look kingly, but God's looking at the inside, and, you know, God chose David. And I guess another thing just from this chapter is how just living under kind of evil human kingdoms, this has been true for Christians like throughout history. And even today, like, you know, so much of the world, Christian world, is under persecution. That God can bring down the mightiest of kingdoms. So just like how we just saw how in Daniel 1, the situation is so bad that you have these, you know, you have these teenagers taken out of where they grew up, what they're comfortable with. But by the end of, I guess, it's been like 60-something years have passed. And within that, like, God has made, Babylon was the greatest kingdom that the world has seen at that time. But, you know, within like 60-something years, God has changed it so much, this other kingdom came and took over. And they're not just, even though, the, you know, Persian army is also, they're still a pagan empire. Their philosophy is so different than we saw how Cyrus is willing to help rebuild the temple. Like, God has made, you know, that big of a difference in their situation. And I guess for me personally, some applications was just kind of head knowledge versus heart change. So Daniel is interpreting the writing, and he knows what it means. And Belshazzar, you know, he's true to his word. He gives him the rewards, but he doesn't really react to what Daniel was saying. You know, I guess it's kind of like you have all the right data and the facts, but you're not really doing anything about it. And this is a lot different from, I guess, kind of how David responded when Nathan the prophet, you know, he kind of, you know, confronts him, and David's response is a lot different, or even, I guess we talked about in a few weeks ago how Nineveh's response to Jonah was a lot different than, I guess, how Belshazzar responds. So I feel like just for me, like, you know, I have a lot of, like, head knowledge, but taking that and translating that to heart changes, it's a difficult process. And also, kind of like we talked about earlier today, just during a time of need, you kind of rely on sources that are other than God. And, you know, kind of the my own kind of wise man kind of thing. So I guess, you know, something like, you know, if there's like a sickness, you know, I first go to WebMD, or, you know, like only if WebMD doesn't give the right diagnosis or the advices are not helping, you know, that's when I think about praying, you know, even though that should probably be the first thing I should do. And it's just relying on stuff that I'm comfortable with and kind of relying on, I guess, myself. And I actually found this quote from C.S. Lewis. He says, "A proud man is always looking down on things and people. And of course, as long as you're looking down, you cannot see something that is above you." And that's from Mere Christianity. And that applies to Belshazzar, and I feel like that definitely applies to me too. And yes, I guess kind of along those lines, like, as much as I want to be kind of like the Daniel character who walks in there boldly and calls out the bad guys, which, you know, sometimes we are called to do that, but I feel like I'm Belshazzar who's kind of messing with sacred things and turning to idolatry, and then I kind of, you know, foolishly thinking that I'm in control when, you know, there is an enemy who's willing, you know, ready to take over at any point. And I guess kind of the worst that reminded me of kind of what to do about that is, I guess, like Micah 6:8, like, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly. And I guess that's kind of the big thing I took out of this chapter. All right, so any last words from anyone else?
Real similar to that. I think the biggest thing I'm taking away from this chapter is when Daniel confronts Belshazzar and says, you knew. You knew all this, and here you are. This is after he recites the history of Nebuchadnezzar. And for me, I just think, how many lessons has God taught me over the years? Things that have happened personally to me, happened, you know, by him proving the validity of what he has already declared in Scripture, things that I've observed in the lives of other people, and yet I persist. I run. You know, God could rightly say that to me. It's like, you knew. What do you expect differently? Well, how can any one of us could probably relate to that. Uh-huh. That was a big takeaway for me. Uh-huh. Chapter 5.
Yeah. And that's kind of the story of Daniel so far, right? We see like the similar story happening in like chapter 2, chapter 4, chapter 5, and we see the, you know, the main characters on. It's really hard for them to get that message, and that's true for us. All right. Anyone else have any other final thoughts? All right. So before we close, so for next week, I mean, you can get started on week 7 if you want to, but I was thinking, so this is, I guess chapter 5 is kind of the end of Babylon, but, you know, Babylon's kind of mentioned throughout the Bible. You'll see a lot of it, especially in, like, Revelation. So I was thinking we can possibly do a study on just kind of, you know, what is Babylon and what does it mean. And if you want some kind of homework, like, you can read Revelation 18. Revelation 18 and Isaiah chapter 13. And, I mean, you can go and, you know, read whatever else you can find about Babylon in the Bible. Isaiah 13. Isaiah 13. Yes. Revelation 18 and Isaiah 13. And anything else you want to read about Babylon. All right, so that's for next Sunday.